From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And then yesterday, as soon as we arrived, they started tear gassing us. There was sound bombs, there was live bullets. Not what I expected at all from a country who has already lost so much.
Lebanon's government is on the brink of collapse following last week's devastating explosion in Beirut's port, which killed at least 200 people and injured thousands. Mass protests were held over the weekend. At least three government ministers have resigned. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Plus, we look at how the new Postmaster General, a major Trump fundraiser, is shaking up the Postal Service, slowing down mail delivery just as Trump escalates his attack on mail-in voting.
Today, we have the Friday night massacre. He fired all the senior service postal executives, the people who've run the day-to-day operations of the post office. This is nothing less than Donald Trump and his political cronies trying to steal the election by blocking or delaying vote by mail.
Then we look at Trump's new coronavirus relief executive orders. A number of Republican lawmakers joined Democrats slamming Trump's actions as unconstitutional. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Lebanon, protests raged over the weekend following the catastrophic explosion last week at the port of Beirut, which killed at least 200 people and injured thousands more and leveled neighborhoods. The explosion was triggered by 2,700 tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate left unattended in a warehouse for 6 years. Protesters stormed three ministries as security forces unleashed tear gas and rubber bullets on demonstrators. This is a protester speaking Saturday.
I'm endangering myself, just like others are doing, because we've reached our limit. Nothing more can happen. Enough corruption, enough negligence, stored substances exploded all of Beirut. And on top of this, there are still people down there at the port who they're shooting with live ammunition, pellets and rubber bullets. They're slaughtering people.
A number of high-level politicians have resigned amidst the growing unrest and accusations of corruption and negligence. The media is reporting Prime Minister Hassan Diab will soon submit his resignation. We'll have more from Lebanon later in the broadcast. President Trump signed four executive orders Saturday after Congress failed to agree on a new coronavirus relief bill. A number of Republican lawmakers joined Democrats, slamming Trump's actions as unconstitutional. Under Trump's orders, unemployed workers will continue receiving an additional $400 a week, but only if states put up a quarter of the money and set up a new system to distribute the payments, a process that could take months. Trump also ordered the deferral of payroll tax collections from workers earning under $100,000, but the taxes will still need to be paid back next year after the election. Trump also signed an executive order on evictions, but it does not extend the federal moratorium that recently expired. This all comes as confirmed coronavirus cases in the United States have topped 5 million, by far the highest caseload in the world, though the true number of cases is likely much higher. As the new school year starts or approaches for kids around the United States, a new report by the American Academy of Pediatrics found nearly 100,000 children contracted COVID-19 in the last 2 weeks of July alone. In Georgia, a high school that recently suspended two students for posting images of classmates, ignoring social distancing guidelines, not wearing masks, being packed by the hundreds into hallways, announced it's implementing remote learning for part of each week after at least 9 students and staffers tested positive for COVID-19. Additionally, sophomore Hannah Watters, who posted the photos, had her suspension reversed. In South Dakota, tens of thousands of motorcyclists rolled into the town of Sturgis Friday for the annual 10-day motorcycle rally, in spite of concerns of local residents. Health experts warn it could turn out to be a super spreader event as images emerged of attendees without masks and not social distancing. The Cheyenne River Sioux set up checkpoints to block the motorcyclists from entering their land to prevent a possible outbreak. In California, the director of the Department of Public Health abruptly resigned Sunday following the discovery of a computer system failure that led to an undercounting of California's COVID-19 cases. Meanwhile, the coronavirus continues to ravage prisons across the country. Over 800 prisoners and 60 prison staff have now died, according to the Marshall Project. In Northern California, San Quentin has now reported 24 deaths. The Orlando Sentinel found many of the prisoners who've died from COVID-19 in Florida prisons were eligible for parole. Over 60 prisoners have died in Florida, according to the report. Globally, coronavirus deaths are approaching 750,000, with nearly 20 million cases. India, the third most infected country, hit a new single-day record with 64,000 cases reported Sunday. This comes as at least 10 people died in a fire at a hotel in the state of Andhra Pradesh that had been converted into a coronavirus care center. Just a few days earlier, a COVID-19 hospital in Ahmedabad caught fire, killing 8 patients. Brazil has become the second country after the United States to pass the milestone of 100,000 deaths, as the outbreak there shows no sign of abating. In Cuba, authorities placed Havana back on lockdown Saturday after a new spike in cases, closing restaurants, bars and pools and beaches. In France, people in Paris will be required to wear a face mask in busier areas starting this week in an effort to slow down a rise in infections that experts warn could spin out of control. Other European countries have also reported new spikes in recent days, including Ireland, Germany, Spain and Italy. New Zealand remains a rare bright spot as it marked 100 days without a domestic transmission Sunday, but warned residents not to become complacent in the fight against the pandemic. In Hong Kong, media tycoon Jimmy Lai was arrested today, the most high-profile arrest yet under the China-imposed national security law. Jimmy Lai is accused of, quote, colluding with foreign powers. Police also raided the newsroom of his publication, Apple Daily. On Friday, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on a number of top officials in Hong Kong, including Chief Executive Carrie Lam, over the crackdown on mass protests. In Belarus, police fired stun grenades, water cannons, and beat and arrested protesters as demonstrations broke out Sunday over the results of the presidential election. Protesters are calling the elections a fraud after incumbent, the authoritarian President Alexander Lukashenko, was declared the winner with 80% of the vote. His main challenger, 37-year-old teacher and political newcomer Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, had gathered significant public support with packed campaign rallies. She entered the race after her husband, who was planning to run, was arrested as part of the government's crackdown on opposition. President Lukashenko has been in power for 26 years and is facing mounting criticism over the failing economy, his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, and his human rights record. Mauritius has declared a state of environmental emergency after a stricken tanker carrying 4,000 tons of fuel began leaking into the Indian Ocean. Miles of the Mauritius coastline have been covered in black sludge as conservationists warn protected coral reefs and endangered species are in serious peril. This is Ruben Pillay, who operates a virtual tour website of Mauritius.
The oil trail is right next to an island called Îles Égrettes, which is a natural reserve with endemic and endangered species there. There's the pink pigeon, there's giant tortoises, there's a tree there that is said to be 400 years old. But for the local people, it's been terrible. These people, they are fishermen, they are boat operators, they are divers, they live from the sea and they eat from the sea.
In Somalia, at least 8 people were killed and 14 others injured after a suicide bomb attack on a military base in the capital, Mogadishu, over the weekend. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the attack. In Yemen, air raids in the north of the country killed at least 9 children, according to a United Nations official. It's the third such attack, resulting in the killing of children in the Houthi-controlled region over the past month. In other news from Yemen, historic houses in the UNESCO-listed old city of Sana'a have been collapsing under heavy rains that have battered Yemen for months. The UN says the torrential rains and flooding have compounded the situation in the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In Venezuela, a court sentenced 2 former U.S. Special Forces soldiers to 20 years in prison over the failed coup attempt in April. Former Green Beret Luke Denman and Aaron Berry were 2 of the 10 men who took part in the attempted ouster of President Nicolas Maduro. The other 8 were killed on site by Venezuelan authorities. In Afghanistan, President Ashraf Ghani approved a measure to release 400 Taliban prisoners, one of the major roadblocks in the embattled peace deal between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Talks between the warring parties are expected to start in Doha this week. Back in the United States, the new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, has overhauled the leadership of the U.S. Postal Service in a move that critics say will give DeJoy more power ahead of the November election, when a record number of mail-in ballots are expected to be cast. 23 Postal Service executives were reassigned or displaced on Friday in what Democrats described as a Friday night massacre. Since taking office, DeJoy has instituted a number of cost-cutting measures that have slowed down the delivery of the mail dramatically. There's now a days-long backlog of mail across the country. Prior to becoming Postmaster General, DeJoy was a major donor to Donald Trump and the Republican Party. In other election news, Hawaiian State Senator Kai Kahele won the primary to replace retiring Congressmember, former Democratic presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard. Kahele would be just the second Native Hawaiian in Congress since statehood. Hawaii has become the 5th state to conduct an election entirely or primarily by mail. In Tennessee, environmental justice activist and political newcomer Marquita Bradshaw handily won the Democratic nomination for retiring U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander's seat. In Arizona, former Sheriff Joe Arpaio has lost his bid to win back his old position to his former chief deputy. In 2017, President Trump pardoned Arpaio for defying a court order to stop his deputies from racial profiling. In Puerto Rico, election officials had to partially suspend voting Sunday, as a number of polling centers had still not received ballots. Puerto Ricans expressed anger and frustration at the election day chaos, as the island is still grappling with last year's political turmoil, which forced then-Governor Ricardo Rosselló to resign over offensive leaked text messages and accusations of corruption. San Juan Mayor and President Trump foe Carmen Yulín Cruz is running to become Puerto Rico's governor. Louisiana's Supreme Court has upheld a life sentence for an African-American man who was convicted of attempting to steal hedge clippers from a home nearly a quarter century ago. Fair Wayne Bryant's life sentence for the 1997 burglary followed his 4th felony conviction, which carries a mandatory minimum prison sentence of 20 years under Louisiana law. In other news from Louisiana, an African-American Gulf War veteran, Derek Harris, will be released from prison after the Louisiana Supreme Court overturned his life sentence for selling less than $30 of marijuana to an undercover police officer. Meanwhile, in Kentucky, authorities are cracking down on protests demanding justice for Breonna Taylor, the Black Louisville resident who was shot inside her own home in March by police. Louisville's Metro Police Department said Sunday that protesters may no longer march in the street and that car caravan protests could face citation or arrest if they disobey traffic laws. In Salt Lake City, Utah, Black Lives Matter protesters who broke windows and splashed red paint outside the district attorney's office in July face a maximum sentence of life in prison. after prosecutors charged them with felony criminal mischief and a gang enhancement. The move to label protesters as gang members has drawn renewed attention to Utah's 1990s-era street gangs law, which disproportionately targets communities of color. Meanwhile, a U.S. district judge in Oregon has extended a restraining order against the U.S. Marshals Service and agents with the Department of Homeland Security, ordering them to stop attacking journalists and legal observers at Black Lives Matter protests in Portland. And Sunday marked 75 years since the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Nagasaki, which killed more than 74,000 people. 3 days earlier, the U.S. had dropped the world's first atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima, killing some 140,000 people. This is Nagasaki Mayor Tomohisa Tai speaking at a commemoration ceremony where he urged the Japanese government to ratify a 2017 nuclear ban treaty and called for a worldwide ban on nuclear weapons.
Same as with the novel coronavirus, which we did not fear until it began spreading among our immediate surroundings, if humanity is not aware of the threat of nuclear weapons until they are used again, we will find ourselves in an irrevocable predicament.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Multiple sources are reporting the Lebanese government is on the brink of collapse amidst protests over last week's massive explosion that devastated much of Beirut and killed at least 200 people, injuring thousands. Dozens are still missing, many of them foreign workers. The explosion was triggered by 2,700 tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate left unattended in a warehouse at the port for over 6 years. So far, at least three ministers and nine members of parliament have resigned, including the justice minister, the information minister, and the environment minister. The prime minister, Hassan Diab, said Saturday the only solution is to hold early elections. As we broadcast, some outlets are reporting Diab will soon submit his resignation. Protesters have also called for a rally to demand the ouster of President Michel Aoun. Al Jazeera reports a Lebanese judge has begun questioning the heads of the country's security agencies about the explosion. This comes after thousands of protesters in Beirut storm government institutions and clash with security forces over the weekend and put up symbolic nooses at Beirut's Martyr Square to hang politicians whose corruption and negligence, they say, is responsible for the blast, as well as Lebanon's deep economic crisis.
Our first reaction after the explosion was that we wanted to clean, to help the people that had been affected. We cleaned the first day, the second day, the third day, and then that's it. We wanted to make our voices heard. What happened is not something new. It has been like this for years. This is unacceptable. It has to end.
And then yesterday, as soon as we arrived, they started tear gassing us. There was sound bombs. There was live bullets. Not what I expected at all from a country who has already lost so much.
International leaders have pledged at least $300 million in humanitarian assistance that will be, quote, directly delivered to the Lebanese population. In a minute, we'll be joined by Wall Street Journal reporter Diane Nissenbaum, who is in Beirut. He went to the blast site on Saturday a few hours before the protests broke out and filmed journalists there as they questioned the prime minister.
But are you going to go onto the streets today or this weekend and speak to people
about
the tragedy?
I'm not sure when I'm going on the streets, but
are you afraid
of
people's fury?
I'm not afraid of people's fury, but of course.
But do they have a right to be furious?
Absolutely, they have the right to be angry and furious. Not just because of this. This is absolutely diabolical what happened. But however, they are also furious even before that for three decades of unbelievable corruption.
That's Lebanon's Prime Minister Diab speaking at the blast site. For more, we are joined in Beirut, Lebanon, by Wall Street Journal reporter Diane Nissenbaum, who co-wrote their investigation headline, Behind the Beirut Explosion, 7 Years of Official Neglect. Diane's 4-year-old daughter, Iman, was injured in the blast. We spoke last week to his wife, Dr. Seema Jalani, the day after the blast. Diane, welcome to Democracy Now! As we speak, is it true that Lebanon's government is falling?
It's true. In between the time that you started your news broadcast and now, a fourth minister, the finance minister, has announced his resignation. So it's the dominoes are falling. It does seem like the prime minister is reluctant to step aside, but if enough cabinet ministers resign, it will effectively become a caretaker government one way or another.
Explain what happened over the weekend. These mass protests, talking about a hard-hit population. I mean, already dealing with the pandemic. You see all these masked protesters in the streets. And then last week on Tuesday, this massive explosion that rocked and leveled a part of the capital city, Beirut, killing. Now the number is, what, 200? Over 5,000 people are injured.
Yeah, you know, one thing to remember about this government is that this is meant to be a technocratic government that was installed after last fall's very joyful and peaceful anti-corruption protest that brought down the former Prime Minister Saad Hariri. So this was a government that was meant to step in and fix the problems and not be too tied to the politicians that have run this country for decades. And there was wariness when they started that they really weren't going to be able to do that. And as you just laid out all of the problems, there's hyperinflation, the currency has collapsed, people can't buy basic goods, the power outages here are up to 22 hours a day. This was all before the explosion. And then this incredible tragedy happens on this beautiful city. And people at first think, you know, it must be Israel, it must be part of a war. And when people find out that it appears to be the result of government negligence, we still, of course, have to find out what the trigger was for this. But the fact that they stored all of this ammonium nitrate in this warehouse for years, knowing that it was a powder keg, it's just basically been the straw that's broken the camel's back here. And people now have absolutely no faith in this government. They're out in the streets. People are disillusioned, disenchanted, and, you know, they're going to look for some sort of change again.
Diane, you tracked where this ship came from. Just tell us very quickly, before we talk about the mass protests and what you saw in the streets, what people are calling for, what happened in 2013? Talk about this ship that came through and why it ended up with this massive amount of ammonium nitrate. I mean, just 2 tons of it took down the Oklahoma City building, killing almost 170 people years ago. This is 2,700 tons of it.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of questions we don't have answered about this ship, but we know that it came from Georgia. It was supposed to be going to Mozambique. Those were the letters it stopped off in Beirut.
This is Georgia, old Soviet bloc country.
Yes, of course. And it was stopped off in Lebanon. There was a series of bureaucratic and financial issues that came up. It was here to try and load on some more cargo to help pay its way to get down south. And then it was deemed too dangerous to travel with the weight. And then it basically was held at the port and the crew was held on board. And they were saying, we're sitting on top of a powder keg. And then it became mired in this bureaucratic travails for years. It was eventually offloaded to warehouses.
So the workers were held on this ship for what, like 11 months before they were? And
yes,
they themselves said they're sitting on a powder keg.
That's right. They were putting up posters and sending back photographs saying, we've got to get out of here. You know, we're sitting on a time bomb, essentially.
And the ship was headed to Mozambique?
That's, you know, these are questions that I will have to tell you we are still searching for answers for. That's what it said at the time. We have some reporting from people in Mozambique saying that they had no indications it was supposed to be coming there. You know, there is an ongoing investigation. We're doing an investigation. Journalists from around the world are doing investigations to determine where this was going, why it was there, what purposes people were intending to use for it, why they never got rid of it. But, you know, there are more questions than answers. at this point.
So they have this volatile substance being held at the port of Beirut. How many people knew about it? Early on after Tuesday, they said they arrested some port guards who were in charge of what? I mean, they can't be in charge of protecting it.
They've arrested 19 people, including the people that run the port. They are going to likely be scapegoats. So the government official at the highest levels knew about this for years. This was not a hidden secret. The port officials tried repeatedly with the courts to try and auction it off or sell it in some way. It was caught in this legal tussle for years. They were apparently going to the wrong court to ask for this, and the court kept saying, "We're not the people that can approve this." But they kept asking the same court over and over again. So it's not clear why those people were asking this court that wasn't the right forum to ask for it. But everybody knew it was there. As I said, it's a tragedy of errors that they never moved it. They never acted on it over more than 6 years, as you said.
And so talk about the scene down at this protest. You were there before the protesters gathered, the questioning of the prime minister, and then what the protesters are demanding. I mean, the day after the explosion, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, came and visited Beirut. Ultimately, the protesters were tear gassed with French tear gas. Is that right?
I don't know about the province of the tear gas itself, but certainly there was a lot of anger at the prime minister for not turning out before the prime minister of France came. There was a lot of real anger on the streets, and the prime minister is seen now as an ineffective leader. I don't know how you're going to have him lead an effective investigation with everything that is happening at this point. When I was at the blast site, there was no sign of actual investigation going on. All you had was divers searching for bodies. All you had was dogs searching for bodies. They're picking up the grain and the corn, leaving the country devastated on the verge of a humanitarian disaster. It's tragedy upon tragedy here. And the fact that the president of France was the one to come here and go out on the streets and meet the people before the prime minister of Lebanon really sort of drove home the point for a lot of people that this is not a government of the people.
And so their demands, and you were recording as the prime minister of Lebanon was being questioned by reporters, but the demands of the protesters in the streets, and will these protests continue even after the current government, what looks like, falls?
Yeah, so what happens when this government falls is it becomes a caretaker until they can put in a new caretaker government, and then you have the negotiations start over who's going to be in the new caretaker government. And the last time they did this, they ended up with this government that really didn't have the confidence of the people. So there'll be continued protests for an effective government. And you already have intense pressure coming from Paris and Washington for the new government to try and distance itself from Hezbollah, the militant and political group here that has significant power and is allied with Iran. So you're facing a number of pressures on Lebanon from various points. You've got U.S. and France trying to put pressure for their agenda. You've got police people in the streets looking for some sort of systemic changes to the political sectarian system here and the corruptive system here that's created this layer upon layer of problems for this country. It's difficult for many of us here to see things getting better in the near term for Lebanon.
Diane, I wanted to end by asking how Iman is, your four-year-old daughter. We spoke with your wife, Dr. Seema Jalani, last week right after the blast. You had both just raced her to the hospital. Talk about what happened to Iman and how she's doing now.
Thank you. Thank you for asking. Yes, she was the most seriously injured of the three of us in the blast. I tried to shield her with my body as the glass and the wood blasted through our apartment, threw myself on top of her. we were able to get her down into an ambulance, and you had the footage of my wife singing lullabies to her in the ambulance as we tried to get to the hospital. The doctors were doing amazing work in a mass casualty situation. Hats off to all of the medical professionals here who handled that situation across the city. Iman was able to get out of the hospital after about a day with lacerations. She's got wounds over her arm and legs and abdomen. She's walked out of the hospital. She limped out on her own 2 feet. She's a very brave girl, and she's watching a lot of screen time these days as we try and just kind of turn the page. She said to us over the weekend, she said, maybe we could move somewhere where there aren't explosions.
Oh, we're showing video right now of her just walking very slowly. And the hospitals, Diane, I mean, that are so hard hit anyway from the COVID virus. You just got him on into a hospital before they closed its doors, and now facing thousands and thousands of people injured in this blast.
Yeah, and the coronavirus, of course, is a major issue here. But several of the hospitals here lost all of their windows as a result of the blast as well. Some of them did have to shut. The hospital we were at was hit, and they continue to operate. The strains on the system here are just mounting. The doctors and the nurses and the medical teams here do amazing work. There are 8 groups in the street treating people in tents, suturing people up in the ruins. So there really are some of the heroes here. And if there's a silver lining, it's really in the people, the medical teams, and the volunteers that are out in the streets here helping the country rebuild.
Diane Nissenbaum, I want to thank you for being with us. Beirut-based Wall Street Journal reporter, co-wrote the investigation behind the Beirut explosion, 7 years of official neglect. His 4-year-old daughter, Iman, injured in the blast. Next up, we look at how the new postmaster general, major Trump fundraiser with massive investments in U.S. post office competitors, is shaking up the Postal Service and slowing down mail delivery, just as President Trump escalates his attacks on mail-in voting. Stay with us. Lowatan by Mishra Leila. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic lawmakers in Washington accusing the Trump administration of sabotaging the United States Postal Service ahead of November's election, when a record number of votes are expected to be cast by mail. On Friday, the nation's new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, shook up the leadership of the agency in a move that critics say will give DeJoy more power. 23 Postal Service executives were reassigned or fired in the restructuring. Prior to becoming Postmaster General, DeJoy was a top Republican donor. He had donated more than $1.2 million to the Trump Victory Fund and had been in charge of fundraising for the 2020 Republican National Convention. Since taking office, DeJoy has instituted a number of cost-cutting measures that have slowed down the delivery of the mail. There's now a days-long backlog of mail across the United States. This comes as President Trump continues to attack mail and voting, Ukraine, claiming the post office can't handle an increase in ballots. Democratic Congress member Jerry Connolly of Virginia accused DeJoy of engaging in, quote, deliberate sabotage to disrupt mail service on the eve of the election. Democratic Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon criticized restructuring of the agency.
Today, we had the Friday night massacre. He fired all the senior service postal executives, the people who've run the day-to-day operations of the post office. This is nothing less than Donald Trump and his political cronies trying to steal the election by blocking or delaying vote by mail. Trump has sued states to try and block vote by mail. That won't work. But he's going to try and stop the mail from being delivered. This is outrageous.
Meanwhile, Senator Elizabeth Warren has co-written a letter urging the Postal Service Inspector General to investigate the changes implemented by DeJoy. Warren also inquired about the financial holdings of DeJoy and his wife, Aldona Vash, President Trump's nominee to be ambassador to Canada. The couple holds as much as $75 million in assets in competitors or contractors of the Postal Service, according to a financial disclosure filed by Vash. This all comes as the U.S. Postal Service is facing a financial crisis, in part due to losses during the pandemic, as well as a controversial 2006 law, which requires the post office to pre-fund its workers' post-retirement health care costs 75 years into the future, something no other government agency is required to do. We're now joined by two guests. Mark Diminstein is the president of the American Postal Workers Union, and David Dayan is executive editor of American Prospect, author of the new book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. David, let's begin with you. Some Democrats are calling this the Friday night massacre. Explain what took place.
Well, it was really a reshuffling of these top executives, some of whom were in positions for, you know, decades, into new parts of the business. A couple were displaced, but mostly it was a reshuffling. I mean, think about it. If you're the person that runs your soundboard now has to do the camera, and the person that runs the camera is now hosting the show. I mean, obviously, these are different skill sets, and it seems like there was a, sort of a randomness to the design of this that would only make sense if you're trying to delay and hinder the mail from being delivered.
And talk about how that mail is being hindered, and also who Louis DeJoy is.
Yeah, well, you said it yourself. I mean, Louis DeJoy is a Trump loyalist. He is a longtime donor. His wife is the nominee for ambassador to Canada, and he was set to be the lead fundraiser on the Charlotte Republican National Convention. So obviously, this is someone with close ties to the president. And in just a matter of weeks, he has instituted these measures that have led to this backlog of days within the Postal Service, testing new sorting systems that seemingly don't really need to be tested right now when the mail is under stress, blocking overtime, and various other measures that have created this delay that pretty much everyone sees. I mean, you know, talk to anybody who has had trouble getting their mail, and you'll know that this is very widespread.
And the fact that DeJoy and his wife, who is now being considered to be the ambassador to Canada, this came out in her filings for that position, have something like $75 to $100 million invested in the U.S. mail services competition or its contractors?
Yeah, it's pretty surprising. I mean, you know, we talk about the impact of this on the elections, but I think the larger goal, and it's a stated goal of much of the Republican Party and certainly this apparatus, is to privatize the service and to give up the monopoly on the mailbox and allow UPS and FedEx primarily to enter into direct competition and degrade the service overall. I mean, it seems clear that's the ultimate intent.
Well, let's bring in the president of the American Postal Workers Union, Mark Dimenstein. If you can respond to everything that has taken place now and the attack on the Postal Service and what some are calling the Friday Night Massacre, what this means for the workers and for the country. I mean, the U.S. Postal Service is older than this country.
That's right. Well, thanks so much for having me on. First, let me just say this. Any policy that slows down the mail runs counter to everything a postal worker stands for. And we're completely opposed to these policies that are delaying mail. And we've let this new postmaster general know that. And we've done it with vehemence. Postal worker, we treat the mail as if it's our own. That's how we're trained. It's our DNA. And our job is to get it to the customer. And we work under a law that says prompt, reliable, and efficient service. Just prompt means quickly. So obviously, it's a demoralizing thing to postal workers who are out here in the front lines of the pandemic as essential workers, connecting the country in these difficult and challenging times, to then be told to delay mail. Now, the Friday night or the Friday massacre, I'm more focused on the policies than who's running what and who's assigned to what. And I think that's where we have to look. The most significant thing, Amy, on Friday, in my opinion, was the new Postmaster General was absolutely silent on the most pressing issue facing the public U.S. Postal Service. And that is Congress coming through with stimulus, financial relief, due to the impact of the pandemic on the Postal Service. So the House of Representatives has passed $25 billion of COVID-related relief to get us through this emergency. Normally, there's no taxpayer dollars. This is one exception. It's now in the hands of the Senate and this administration. It's an ask of the Postal Board of Governors, a unanimous ask. In March, Congress and this administration took care of the private side to the tune of over $500 billion. It's about time that Congress took care of the public side, including the United States Postal Service. And there was absolute silence on that key question facing the people of this country right now in terms of what's going to happen to their public postal services.
The Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, called DeJoy to the Hill on Wednesday. Can you talk about what happened at that meeting?
Well, I wasn't at the meeting. I can just read the news, and apparently they certainly weighed in on their concerns about these policies of slowing down the mail, focused on just arbitrarily saying there's not going to be any more overtime. Here we are in a COVID world. 40,000 postal workers have been quarantined since March, over 2,500 sick, and so obviously leave is up. And
how many postal workers have died?
We've had over 75 postal workers who have passed away from COVID, and that's just what's known and identified. So it's certainly more than that. I'm sorry, I got lost in the.
What they talked about at that meeting, Schumer and Pelosi with DeJoy.
So they from the news, they voiced their concerns about the policies, as I was starting to say, about overtime, transportation changes. Hours in the retail units, pulling out of sorting machines. And I know that that was raised from reading the news. And I'm quite sure that both raised the need for the COVID financial relief to the tune of $25 billion. And that $25 billion is not going to CEOs and shareholders. It's going to the people of the country to make sure we can continue to carry out what we call our universal service mandate. That small D democratic right that no matter who we are and where we live, we have an equal access to public postal services at a uniform and reasonable rate.
Last week, the Trump campaign sued the state of Nevada over its plan to send absentee ballots to all registered voters, but the president has supported mail-in voting in Florida. Last week, Trump said part of the reason is that Florida has a Republican governor.
Florida's got a great Republican governor, and it had a great Republican governor. It's got Ron DeSantis, Rick Scott, two great governors. And over a long period of time, they've been able to get the absentee ballots done extremely professionally. Florida is different from other states. I mean, in Nevada, where you have a governor, he said, let's just send out millions of ballots and the post office cannot be prepared. I haven't spoken to the post office about it, but I don't know how they could possibly be prepared.
So President Trump has been seriously attacking mail-in voting. David Dayan, I wanted to bring you back in on this issue, and particularly talking about how he won't trust the election if the results aren't in November 3rd at night. Talk about the significance of all this and what he said. Now he's, because there's been such pushback by Republican governors in the country that use mail-in voting, he is saying, no, in Republican states, you can have it. You can trust it.
Yeah, and that's also campaigns who are saying that, you know, by demonizing vote by mail, Republicans are losing what is actually a traditional advantage for Republicans who traditionally vote by mail in higher numbers. And this was sabotaging the efforts to get out the vote and bank those votes early in the election. So, yeah, absolutely. There's an effort underway to delegitimize this election. It's obviously going to take longer to count absentee and mail-in ballots than it would to count ballots that are cast at the polling places. And so, November 3rd, we're not going to see the end of this election. And, Trump is setting the stage for it on the night of November 3rd, whatever the count is, he can use that to potentially declare victory. So it's a very dangerous situation. The public, I don't think, is necessarily fully informed that this is going to be a long process, like we see here in my state of California, where it takes weeks to eventually count all of the ballots and sometimes races change. That's going to lead to cries of fraud and delegitimization, and it's a very difficult situation.
You're right. The Postal Service has informed states they'll need to pay first-class 55-cent postage to mail ballots to voters rather than the normal 20-cent bulk rate.
Yeah, my understanding is that there was a meeting where the Postal Service officials said that they would like to see that happen. That will take quite a bit of doing, changes in the regulatory system at the Postal Regulatory Commission and some other factors. There would obviously be litigation to that. But just the threat of this, that they're going to almost triple the price that it would take for states and counties to pay to get those ballots out, could lead some states to say that we're not going to take up the expense, just fearing that the rates will increase, even though there's a very short window to do this, and it may be unlikely. It may be used as a very convenient excuse to hinder ballots from getting out.
Finally, Mark Dimenstein, do you think President Trump is trying to sabotage the U.S. Postal Service in the lead up to the election?
Well, I think we can let President Donald Trump speak for himself on this question. In June 2018, the Office of Management Budget of the White House put out in writing a proposal to privatize, i.e. break up the Postal Service and sell it to private corporations where they can then make private profit. And of course, whether people get postal services at all will then depend on who they are, where they live, and how much it would cost if they can even get services at all, because somebody would have to then be able to make or want to make a quick buck. So it's in writing. It is their plan. So we're very concerned that any policies that undermine and degrade service to the people of this country have a goal of undermining the public support for the Postal Service. You can't privatize a public Postal Service that people trust, people love. 91% of the people of the country in a recent Pew Research poll rated the post office favorably at 91%. It's the most popular brand, the number one brand during this COVID pandemic. That's an indication of how much people appreciate the role of postal workers, how much people trust it. So the only way you can get to privatization is if you undermine people's confidence and support in the institution. And anything that slows down the mail does that. And if I could say, if we have time, Amy, just on vote by mail. We've been doing vote by mail for generations as postal workers. We're not beholden to any candidate, any political party. It's part of our proud civic responsibility and duty to the people of the country. And what's more important than that, than providing access to the ballot box? It's ever more popular from election cycle to election cycle. 2018, 31 million people voted by mail, including the president himself. There's no difference between vote by mail and absentee balloting, and it's been proven, the facts say, that it works. And the state of Oregon's been doing it 19 years by law. 100 million, over 100 million ballots cast, 15 cases of voter fraud. So this idea that it's corrupt, it's fraudulent, the results of the election shouldn't be accepted, or the tyrannical trial balloon that somehow the election maybe should be postponed because of the fraudulent problems with vote by mail, that in itself is a fraud on the people of this country. People can trust vote by mail. They people are going to have to vote quickly when they get their ballots. But in this pandemic, literally, it's going to make the difference between whether tens of millions of people have access to the ballot box. Postal workers can handle this. The idea that there's not capacity is just wrong, and it really works well. And it's a great way for people to exercise the hard-fought and charity. Democrat, right?
Mark Dimenstein, I want to thank you for being with us, President of the American Postal Workers Union. And David Dayen, I'd like to ask you to stay with us after break. We want to look at Trump's new coronavirus relief executive orders. What do they mean? Even Republican lawmakers have slammed them as unconstitutional. Stay with us. Postman by the Marvelettes. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump signed four executive orders Saturday, including measures to extend unemployment benefits and defer payroll taxes after Congress failed to agree on a new coronavirus bill. But it does not look like those unemployment benefits will necessarily be seen by people who are unemployed. A number of Republican lawmakers joined Democrats slamming Trump's actions as unconstitutional. Democrats had hoped to extend a program to give unemployed workers an additional $600 in weekly benefits and to extend a federal moratorium protecting some renters from evictions. Under Trump's order, unemployed workers would continue receiving an additional $400 a week, but only once states put up a quarter of that money and set up a new system to distribute the payments, a process that could take months if they can afford it at all. Trump also signed an executive order on evictions, but it won't stop any evictions from happening. It simply instructs the Treasury Department and the Department of Housing and Urban Development to consider taking action. Trump also ordered the deferral of payroll tax collections for workers earning under $100,000, but the taxes will still need to be paid back next year after the election. And Trump vowed to pursue the permanent elimination of the payroll tax, which is used to fund Social Security and Medicare, if he's reelected. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi criticized Trump's executive actions in an interview with Fox News Sunday.
While it has the illusion of saying we're going to have a moratorium on evictions, it says, I'm going to ask you, the folks in charge to study if that's feasible. While he says he's going to do the payroll tax, what he's doing is undermining Social Security and Medicare.
Still with us, David Dayen, executive editor of The American Prospect, where he writes a daily update on the coronavirus pandemic called Unsanitized. His book is just out. It's titled Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. So, David, talk about what happened this weekend. Talk about these executive orders, these executive actions, and what they mean. Start with unemployment, such a severe crisis in this country right now.
Yeah, so talks between Democrats and the White House broke off, and as a result, Trump decided to go forward with these executive orders. And as you mentioned, there's a lot less than meets the eye here. On unemployment, as you say, it's $400 a week, which is much less, of course, than the $600 a week boost that had been given. States are supposed to supply a quarter of that. States are obviously very cash-strapped right now. It's supposed to come from a budget that has already been given to the states, but a lot of that money is already spoken for. As for the $300 that the government is federal government is supposed to supply, that comes from a fund for disaster relief, FEMA disaster relief. And so, as you say, it's done under a different program that has to be now put into the state unemployment systems, which are very rickety. Some of them use a programming code that is decades and decades old. And the last time when the $600 boost came in, that took weeks in some states to actually get done. And the amount of money that's being appropriated for this purpose would only last maybe 5 weeks tops, even though it's supposed to extend until December.
So, and if the state doesn't put in 100 of the $400, the federal government won't put in the other 300.
I'm not sure that that is true, but the problem is that you have to get the system to actually work correctly. And each state, there's no sort of each state getting that $300. Each state has to do it, and it's first come, first serve. And if the money is drained, it's drained. There's only $44 billion appropriated. So, you know, you could see the faster states getting up to speed, and states that might take months to get this done getting just locked out at the door, and their unemployed residents end up getting no benefit whatsoever. Even a state that is quote-unquote fast about this, but residents are probably not seeing any unemployment extended benefits until at least September.
So Trump walked out of his announcements this weekend. By the way, he's holding all this news conference and announcements at his private golf club in New Jersey.
Yeah.
With
yeah, in
the
front,
people
in
around
front of,
him. Describe
yeah, in
the
front
scene.
Of country club. Yeah, in front of country club members who, you know, pay to be there. And we're pretty vocal, I think, during a couple of these press conferences. That is where he, in fact, signed these. And you know, it's very much just sort of political theater. The question is, while I do believe that these are unconstitutional, Congress has the power of the purse. He's reprogramming funds. Who is exactly going to sue over this and deny workers even a meager amount of unemployment benefits? I think that this is going to set a really dangerous precedent that executives have much more power in the fiscal realm than previously thought.
As the government is giving billions to companies, for example, around viruses, some that have never, around vaccines that have never even made vaccines. I mean, billions and billions of dollars. What about the moratorium on evictions?
I mean, it's a non-proposal. It's an order that says, hey, HUD and Treasury, come up with something. Help us out. Maybe don't allow people to be evicted or foreclosed upon. It is not an extension of the moratorium in any way, either on evictions or on foreclosures. It's completely unknown what steps will be taken by Treasury or the Department of Housing and Urban Development in exchange. And it protects really nobody. The only protections that are in place are at the state level, and many of those are expiring. And of course, when you take away that $600 a week support from unemployment, a lot of these unemployed residents who are going to be, many of whom are renters, are going to have trouble making that next rent payment. The Census Bureau put together a thing called the Household Pulse Survey, and it shows about one quarter of Americans who are renting fear that they're not going to be able to make that next payment.
And talk about the payroll tax. Trump basically saying what this means for Social Security.
Yeah, it's a deferral. So it's you know, you're eventually going to have to pay that. I suspect a lot of businesses will just put that money in escrow so that they're not told later down the road, oh, you have to pay all that, and then garnishing their employees' checks to the tune of entire checks worth. So I suspect this will have almost no stimulative effect. If Trump succeeds in making this permanent, of course, he would need Congress to do that. But that would be a complete undermining of the system of funding for Social Security and Medicare. And Democrats obviously jumped right on that, after the announcement was made.
Well, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us, David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect, where he writes a daily update on the coronavirus pandemic called Unsanitized. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Brick, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.